to the Creative Pen Podcasts. I'm Joanna Penn, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options, internet sales and promotion for your book. The companion website is www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, this is Joanna Penn for the Creative Pen Podcast, and today I'm interviewing T. Morris. T is an author of fiction and non-fiction books, including the fantastic Billabob Badding series. He was one of the first podcasters, co-founded podiobooks.com, and is also a speaker on Web 2.0 and social media. Hello, T.
Hi, how are you? You forgot to mention the fantastic Thanks for the Memories podcast, Billabob Baddings and the Case of the Singing Sword.
Yes. And I highly recommend anyone listening to the Billy Badding series. And I was just commenting that he's a breast man. So
yeah, he's a breast. He's definitely a breast.
He is. So that's brilliant. And okay, there are so many questions I had for you, T, but I had to kind of, you know, bring it down a bit. So first of all, just give us a quick intro about you and your writing background, because I know you've been writing for years.
Well, yeah, but actually, unlike some writers, I was a late bloomer. I was writing casually. I mean, I wrote as an outlet. My passion was acting, and it was actually from an acting gig that I came up with that I got the inspiration for my first novel, which was Moravia: The Chronicles of Rafe and Ascana. Rafe Rafton was the last character I played at the Maryland Renaissance Festival back in 1997 or something like that, and then. And I still remember I was in the lead role of Figaro, not the opera, but the straight play Figaro. And, you know, here I am. I'm literally walking off stage, and the actors all thought I was crazy because I would literally come off the stage, go right to my computer, type, and then to the last possible moment, I would get up and be ready for my cue.
Wow.
And it was like a mill. The only time I ever missed a cue was never when I was writing, but when I was reading, of all things, a graphic novel. And I still remember I was really into this graphic novel, and I'm trying. It was one of the Batmans. I think it was one of the Batmans. And someone said T T, and I looked up and I was like, "What?" And they're like, "You're on!" And I'm like, "Crap!" So I missed my cue that night. But anyway, while writing is not the bane of existence, I believe graphic novels are, because they make me miss my cues. But anyway, Moravia was first published in 2002. Shortly after that, I'd published two other books plus numerous articles in the Complete Guide to Writing Fantasy series, which is done by Dragon Moon Press as well. And then I wrote Podcasting for Dummies with Evo Terra in 2005, and that pretty much brings me up to speed. I mean, I've been writing both fiction and I've been writing with, like I said, both sides of the brain. And you talk about something very surreal. My first science fiction fantasy convention as an author was this tiny little convention called Matacon. Mm. And the guest of honor was Julie Trinada. Well, just two weekends ago, I was at Conscription in New Zealand, and the guest of honor was Julie Trinada. And the two of us, so here we are, we're both in our first New Zealand conference together, and it was just like old times. And we actually did a panel called Writing with Both Sides of the Brain, and we talked about what it was to be a writer and to write both fiction and nonfiction, and both the pluses and minuses of that.
Mm. No, that's brilliant. And I guess, you know, talking about Moravia, you podcasted that, and I seem to read on the internet it was like the first podcasted novel or something like that.
First novelty podcast in its entirety. The hair that people want to split between me and my friend Scott Sigler. Yes, he is my friend. a lot of people don't think Scott Sigler has friends, but trust me, if there's anybody you want in your corner, it's Scott Sigler. Scott was the first person to podcast a novel, and it was an exclusive. You know, you could only find this novel in podcast format. But I was the first. I actually started in January. And a few months later, Scott joined in on the fray. At that time, was called the Dragon Page, and in 2005, that was the beginning. It was myself, Mark Jeffrey, and Scott Sigler.
So why did you decide to do podcasting then, if it was, you know, so new? Did you make it up, or, you know, how did that happen? How did you come up with that idea?
You got to go back in time a bit. I've been meaning to podcast the book premiere, my book premiere for Moravi, because what I did for my book premiere, because I said I was an actor, and I think I still am an actor. But I got together with some friends of mine who are stage combatants. And we all got done up in garb, and I show up for my first book signing, and these pirates crash my book signing, and there was a sword fight. I mean, and I wind up winning the sword fight by beating the bad guy up with my book, and the last line of the sketch is, the pen truly is mightier than the sword. And I've been meaning to put that online. It was, 'cause it was a lot of fun to launch a book that way.
Yeah.
And we sold a lot of books that night. And my publisher said, well, T, come up with something just as cool. No pressure. Just come up with something cool. And I was like, okay. So I'm racking my brain. And at the time, I was listening to podcasts. The first podcast I ever listened to was, in fact, The Dragon Page with, at that time, Michael R. Meninge and Evo Terra. And I was picking up other podcasts. There was the Rev Up Review from Paul S. Jenkins. There was Slice of Sci-Fi, of course. And another one called Slacker Astronomy, which was hosted by one of its hosts was Dr. Pamela Gay. I got the biggest crush on her. Anyway, I was listening to this stuff, and I thought to myself, you know, wouldn't it be cool if, as part of the Dragon Page, because the Dragon Page is a literary science fiction fantasy magazine about literature in the genre. And I said, wouldn't it be cool if I talked to the guys at the Dragon Page and they helped me podcast my novel. And what I would do is I would just release it a chapter at a time, and it would lead up to the beginning of to Legacy of Moravi, which was the sequel coming out in 2005. So I sat down with Michael and Evo, and they both said to me, you know, that's an awfully long book, T. And I said, I think it'll work. At about chapter 10, I thought, man, this is an awfully long book. But what started as really a promotional stunt really became a new movement. And I didn't even see it coming until people were downloading, they were downloading all three books. They were downloading me, Pocket Independent, and Earthcore. And people were just raving about it, and they were really digging it. And from there, you know, Podio Books took place, and we just ran with it. So yeah, I mean, it started as a way to promote Legacy of Moravi, and I'm very proud of from humble beginnings what has started as really for some people a new way of telling stories.
No, and it's fantastic. And I've been listening to quite a lot of nonfiction podcasts, but, you know, started listening.
You're going to podcast one of your works. That's what I want to know.
Well, and in fact, you know, JC Hutchins challenged me on this as well. So I'm going to, but I write nonfiction at the moment, so I am going to podcast those. But,
we do podcast nonfiction. As a matter of fact, for my nonfiction titles, something you might want to consider. One of the things I do for my nonfiction titles is I will actually do addendums. I won't actually podcast the nonfiction, but I will podcast addendums to the nonfiction. That's what I did with Podcasting for Dummies, and I intend to do with my Twitter books.
No, absolutely.
But we do nonfiction at Podio Books, so that does not get you off the hook.
Yes, I saw that. I did see that, and it's going to happen. It's going to happen. But one thing I wanted to ask you is, you know, you used to be an actor, and I've listened to, you know, a number of podcasts you're on as a voice talent. And, you know, how much of podcasting is performance, and how can authors who are sort of quieter than you, you know, get into this and sort of, you know, practice that sort of performance?
Well, at conscription, Julie actually asked me to step up and be a prop, as it were, in this one panel where we were talking about what it means to be a writer. And one of the things that Julie and I both agree with, and a lot of other writers kind of nod their heads, but they're like, I don't know if I can do that. But the thing is, you have to do that, is you have to get good at reading. You have to get good at reading, because when you do a live reading, you are selling the book. And I think in every creative field, to some extent, you have to be an actor. And when it comes to readings, you know, what you do is, you know, you find somebody that you like on television. You learn to impersonate that voice as close as you can, and then that's the voice of one of your characters in the book when you give a reading. you really have to sell it. And for me, when I'm recording my podcast, whether it's Billy, whether it is the new version of Moravia that just went online, you know, it's all about selling it, about believing in your work. And when you have that belief in what you're doing and what you're saying, it comes out and it makes people want to buy the book. Mm. You know, for example, with Billy, the opening goes Chicago, 1929. There are 1,000 stories in the naked city. And when you're a dwarf at 4'1", they all look that much taller. My name is Billy Bob Battings. I'm a private eye. I know you're probably scratching your noggin saying, how the hell did a dwarf from the Highlands of Gryphonos become a gumshoe in the streets of Chicago? Now, some people will read it like that.
Yeah. You don't. I know you don't.
No, I don't. Because to me, I'm selling it. So when I sell it, you go, you enjoy it. You know, Chicago, 1929. There are 1,000 stories in the naked city. And when you're a dwarf at 4'1", they all look that much taller. You know, I mean, and what am I doing? I'm doing Stacy Keach when he was Mike Hammer in the television series Mickey Splains Mike Hammer. I make no bones about that. That was a big influence on me, was Mike Hammer. And you know, you got to sell it. That's what you do. And, you know, people go, well, I feel like an idiot. I'm like, look, you just got your work published and you're putting it out there for the world to see. That already is – that's a step in the right direction. Now you just got to go one more step, and it's no different than when you get your work published. When you get your work published, you've basically just put a target on yourself. Well, when you give a reading, you're just making the target a little bit brighter. And I say go for it, because you got nothing to lose at this point except the sale.
Yeah, no, and that's a very good point. And perhaps, you know, should people just have a go, record themselves, and then delete the first file or something like that and do it again?
I think rehearsal is a good thing. I don't think you have to record it unless you want to listen to it and take notes for yourself. Mm. I mean, I'm big on reviewing, just reviewing all the files. But I'm also a big proponent of sitting down and reading the chapter cold. Then I will fire up the mics, and then I'll read it for recording. And I will also say, okay, if I didn't like that, I have a little dog training clicker, and I will actually fire that off, and you know, and then I'll do another take. Mm. There's nothing, you know, there's no rule that says you have to get it right in one take. And to me, this isn't, you know, people go, well, T, you're an actor, you're the ringer. I'm like, no, I'm just having a really good time. And the important thing, and I felt the same way about being an actor. I never felt like I was an artist suffering for my art. No, I was having a really good time.
Sorry. I was going to say, that's what I've got from listening to yours and Pips and JC. And, you know, you guys have such a good time. You know, it's amazing.
I tell you, there was a lot of fun I had bringing Hutch and bringing Sigler. In fact, in a recent when I did the remastered version of Moravia, I had a scene that was with Scott Sigler, P.G. Holyfield from Murder at Avedon Hill, and Chris Lester from Metamore City. So I had all three of them in the same scene, and it was just great having the banter between the three of them, and then having Hutch step up. And Hutch, I remember, told me, he said he loves reading fantasy, and he apparently got a big kick out of appearing in this fantasy role as a big burly general, you know, on his horseback and yada, yada, yada. And he said, oh my God, I got to call Pippa whore. I don't think I like this role, T. And I said, just roll with it. You know, it was really good fun. It was really good fun. And I think that's part of why we do what we do, is because if the passion isn't there, you hear it. And that's, you know, and I've said this before on other podcasts, I'll say it here. If you really want to hear a passion for what you're reading, you know, for what you're doing, you know, listen to Pip, listen to any of the stuff that Pip does, the stuff that Hutch does. But for Scott Sigler, you know, people go, oh, Nocturnal's the best, or this one's the best. I always say, go to The Rookie. It's the one that I think Scott doesn't sell as much, mainly because I don't think it's with a major house. But in my personal opinion, it's his best work. Mm. And he's even said it's his best work. And when you hear him read it, good golly, the passion just blows you away. And I think that's why – of all of Scott's works, The Rookie is still my favorite, and I always will be.
Mm. That's great. Okay, so as well as your fiction, you also co-wrote the Podcasting for Dummies. So you obviously feel that other people should be podcasting. And I mean, obviously, there's a lot of unpublished authors now podcasting. So why is podcasting so important for unpublished authors to start doing, I guess, these days?
Well, it's great because it really is the acid test for how marketable and also how you as a writer are going to be able to handle feedback. That's one way. But another way is that you build yourself a fan base. No matter if it's a fan base of 10 or a fan base of 10,000, you are building yourself a fan base. And to ignore podcasting or to say, you know, and this is the part where I get a little uptight with the publishing industry on a whole. They're like, well, we can't give this away. We can't give this away. We can't give this away. And you go, why? Well, we want to retain the audio rights. But I always turn back to, but you're not going to be turning this book into an audio book for certain, are you? You know, you just want to retain the audio rights just in case. But if you look at the percentage of books that are turned into audio books versus, you'll see that it's dramatically low. It is insanely low. And and not every book that comes out is going to be released in audio. So when I hear that publishers do not want to release new books as podcasts, I go, you know, you're cutting your nose off in spite of your face. But you hear authors do the same thing. Well, I don't want it to be spent material. I'm like, no, it's not spent material. You're throwing it out there. And if you can go to a publisher with the numbers and say, this is how many downloads I've had, they're going to want a piece of that. They are going to want a piece of that. But it's still that old school mentality with publishing. Now, that being said, I also don't think that podcasting is a numbers game. There have been several authors who have podcasted their work and they just they get on their blogs and they vent on how low their numbers are. And I'm the first one to step up and I go, look, if you're doing it for the numbers, you're doing it wrong. I never podcast Moravi. And I never went. And when I went back to remaster Moravi in 2008, my intentions were never to get Garbanzo numbers. My intention was to tell a good story and to have a good time doing it. Mm. And that's what it should be. And, but, you know, but as far as the writer in me, was like, I was like, this is a great way to share my work and also to give it its own original spin, you know, in audio and see if people really dig it or not. And if they don't dig it, I can go back and rework it. If they do dig it, then I can pitch it to a larger house. You know, the proof is in the pudding. I mean, you know, you see it with Mer Lafferty, you see it with Matthew Wayne Selznick, you see it with J.C. Hutchins, you see it with Scott Sigler. And Pip herself, you know, she had her numbers from Chasing the Bard. Agent took it to a New York publisher, said this is her fan base. And they read Geist and said, we want it. So, you know, it does work. You know, to quote Terry Brooks, sometimes the magic works. And I believe that in podcasting as well.
Yeah.
It's an avenue that if podcasters, I mean, if authors ignore it, they're really missing out.
Mm, and that does seem to have changed quite recently, hasn't it? I mean, you know, the authors you talk about have all started to get, you know, these big deals quite recently.
Yes.
So it's built up over a number of years.
It's still got a long way to go, though. Still got a long, long way to go. And and also, there are some authors that that still retain that, and some vendors retain that old school mentality. The two things that tend to be the big deterrent, you know, a case in point was that someone approached an audio publisher approached me to do a podcast. They said they wanted to do a podcast. I said, okay, what do you want to do? And they said, we don't know, but we know it's cool, so we want to do a podcast because we're cool. And I was like, oh, really? I said, okay, well, let's test that cool factor. Take your smallest or the one title that isn't moving right now and podcast it. And she was like, well, you mean like the first five chapters? I said, no, the whole thing. And that's when she got a little condescending with me. And she was like, T, you don't understand what goes into an audio production. And I'm like, oh, I don't. I don't understand what goes into, oh, okay. You know what? This meeting is done. And then I proceeded to turn around and go on a panel on here's how you podcast a novel. You know, I mean, that tends to be the first deterrent, is that people don't want to give it away.
Mm.
The second deterrent is when people say, well, I don't know if I have that time. it's not even an issue of the equipment. I mean, if you wanted to use a built-in microphone for your computer, and you know, just some simple music that you pull off of GarageBand, you know what? That'll work just fine. But people tend to be turned off by the time factor.
Mm.
And I say, fine, then don't do it. Because the last thing you want to do is start to podcast a novel and then say, you know what? I don't think I want to do this anymore. Because when you stop in the middle of a production, not only is it extremely amateur, but it is also it's breaking an agreement you've made with your fans. And the agreement you've made with your fans is, I'm podcasting this novel, I'm going to finish it. Which is why for some of us, you know, it took Scott a long time to do Nocturnal, took me a long time to do Murray V. Remastered, took P.G. Holyfield a long time to do Murder at Avedon Hill. But the one thing you can say about all three of us is, yeah, it took us a while, but we finished.
Yeah.
And that's the agreement that you make with the people that you want to start up a fan base with. And as far as the fan base, as the fans just taking and not giving back, no. The fans will support you because they believe in your work.
No, absolutely. And I guess one of the sites where people can find, because some people might be listening and they've never listened to one before, a podcast novel. And so you started podiobooks.com. Yes. So can you tell us a bit about that site and how can authors, I mean, obviously people can go there, download books and listen to them, but how can authors also get on that themselves?
Well, Evo, Chris Miller, and myself started up podiobooks.com. Evo basically was the front man, still is the front man. At one time, I was the acquisitions editor. I was the one that basically checked to make sure that all the tech was right on that first chapter. And Chris Miller was the code shaman that made everything work. Between the three of us, we started up podiobooks.com. And there are suggestions on if you go to the website, you'll see a place where authors can click. And they can say, you know, these are the steps on how to become a podiobook author. We also have the Ning community for podiobooks.com, and we have a mentorship program there. And we answer questions. We help authors get started. The way that the submissions work is that you have to produce so many chapters beforehand plus a promo. And once you do all that, you'll have an idea of how much work will go into your particular podiobook. And based on that, you know, when you meet all the requirements, all the technical requirements and stuff like that, you submit it to Podiobooks and Podiobooks takes it from there. The only times that we've ever turned down books is if people do not set up our if they don't set up their files the way we want them and they're insistent on that. Another time we will reject work is if we're suspicious of the content. And what I mean by suspicious of the content, we don't support hate agendas. Yes, it is a very slippery slope that we get on, but we'll say, you know, we go, you know what, why don't we go ahead and hear the entire book? And we've had some people say, well, I don't want to do that. And we go, well, then, you know, go ahead and podcast it on your own. the third time that we turn down work is if people have come to Podiobooks, start up a novel, and then they just fade. And then they come back and they go, well, I don't want to finish that one, but I want to do this one. We're like, no, you don't. You got to finish the first one. And I mean, the rules of Podiobooks are pretty straightforward. And all we do is we ask for the content. We then accept donations, and it works that 75% goes to the author and 25% we retain over at Podiobooks just to make sure that the site stays running. So far, so good. We've been doing really well up there.
Mm. And it is a great site, so I urge listeners to go and have a look there.
All the books there are free, but we do ask for a donation. And when you consider that we're giving this stuff away for free, and considering some of the talent that has come, both published and unpublished, you know, $10 is pretty cheap for a full audio production.
Mm, absolutely. Okay, so running out of time, just got a couple more questions. I wanted to ask you, because you're part of Dragon Moon Press, which is a sci-fi fantasy publishing house, and I read on the website that they encourage first-time authors. So how are the changes in publishing right now affecting Dragon Moon Press, and also what are your thoughts on new authors currently in this time of change?
Well, for one thing, I would say that Dragon Moon Press is very bold in how they're doing business. in such a crappy economy, Dragon Moon is still churning out books, and so far they're doing it with a lot of success. There's Nina Kimberly, The Merciless, which just came out. Again, another podcast author, Christiana Ellis. And there's another podcast author who's about to make his big debut with Dragon Moon, and it's Phil Rossi. And then, of course, the aforementioned P.G. Holyfield, he'll have his Murder at Abaddon Hill also coming out through Dragon Moon Press. So there's a lot of things that are happening. And I applaud Dragon Moon for being so aggressive in such a crappy economy. As far as new authors and new authors approaching Dragon Moon, my thoughts are you need to have what I think, you know, both small and large publishing houses are looking for is if you have a plan, a marketing plan or some type of marketing initiative in place, whether it is podcasting, whether it's working with social media initiatives like Twitter and Facebook or otherwise, something where the author has to take a more aggressive approach to marketing. One of the things that I hear a lot of the old school authors say, and I find it really arrogant when they say it. I've heard people say, oh no, promotion and marketing is someone else's job. That's not mine. I'm a writer. And I'm like, you know what? That's a straight shot to the mid list. The only people who can say, you know, marketing is not my thing are people like Dan Brown, Anne Rice, and Stephen King, because these guys are names. John Grisham does not have to go out and promote his books. Dan Brown does not have to go out and promote his books. But what's really important and what's kind of essential here is they have to understand they being the new authors have to understand that when that first book comes out, you are not Stephen King, you are not John Grisham, you are not Dan Brown, you know, you're not any of these household names, even though there are a lot of authors that make that claim. I've been writing both fiction and nonfiction since 2002, been published since 2002. And I believe I promote myself just as hard now as I did back in 2002. I need to promote myself even harder because the field is just getting more competitive. And on top of that, I know that no one else is going to promote my work better than me. I'm not a household name. I freely admit that. I am not. But even if I do become a household name, and considering that I call out Oprah Winfrey in my next Twitter book, that might make me a household name. You know, I'm not going to back down. I'm still going to be promoting just as hard because that's what makes bestsellers bestsellers. Is they are in the trenches and they are working.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I think we're all aware of that now. We have to promote ourselves. And you mentioned there your next book, which is All a Twitter. And I know you're a huge fan of social networking and you also speak on Web 2.0. So can you maybe talk a bit about why Twitter is so important right now and how authors can use it to promote their books?
Well, I see a lot of authors dabbling on Twitter. And for some authors like Neil Gaiman, what they're using Twitter is they're using Twitter as their own personal press kit. That's fine. You know, I mean, you know, Neil Gaiman's Neil Gaiman. You know, I admire what he's doing, to an extent. When he got into a numbers competition with some other people, I felt a little twinge of disappointment because to me, Twitter is not a numbers game. And I've seen other authors get on Twitter and just give it a shot and say, well, this isn't for me. This is a time sink. But a majority of writers are using Twitter to connect with their fans. A majority of writers I see on Twitter are using Twitter to network with other writers, but also to broaden their resources, particularly when they're writing books. and I think those who get it, those who really get Twitter or any social network realize that it's more of a personal connection with fans. And For some writers, they don't want to get that personal. You know what? More power to them. The thing about social networking. Matter of fact, that's why I'm here. I'm actually doing some talks on social media here in New Zealand. I was on Radio New Zealand yesterday morning. I had a great time on there. But the guy I was having the discussion with, he said to me, you know, where do you draw the line? More or less, he said, where do you draw the line? Is this the downfall of literacy as we know it? And I said, you know, look, I've written, you know, three books on this topic, on this subject matter, and I've got a fourth one coming. Trust me, it's not making us less literate. You know, it's actually broadening our lives. And then he said something very poignant. He said, yeah, but you get it. And I was flattered by that, but I still feel like I'm learning. I mean, I learned more about Twitter. I've been on Twitter since early 2007, and yet I learned more about Twitter while I was writing all of Twitter. What I think is that it really social media on a whole works the way you want it to work. If you want to use it as your personal press kit, a la Neil Gaiman, you know what? More power to you, Neil. You got the Newbery Award. I don't. And I completely acknowledge that. But if I want to use Twitter as a personal communication tool with my fans, and when I promote, they know that I'm not using it just for promotion's sake, but I'm using it to communicate and to connect with people. I feel like with me, it's more about an issue of I have fans that have made a personal vested interest in me, and they're going to do their part as well to promote my works. But they also know that I'm not all about promotion. I'll talk about, you know, a day that I'm having with my kid, or I'll talk about how, you know, I just walked through Hobbiton and it was the coolest thing ever, you know. And really, fans dig that because they get a personal, they get a more personal look into what's happening when I'm not writing.
Yeah.
So I think Twitter, I find that of all the different social initiatives that are out there, Twitter's my favorite because it's, you know, you can, it's very low maintenance. It is not a time sink. You can come in, make a quick statement, come out, and then when you come back to Twitter, there are a bunch of replies waiting for you. And I just find it to be a lot of fun. I find it to be a lot of fun.
I'm with you there. I love Twitter as well. And that's where we connected. And yes. Okay, so we're out of time. So where can people find out more about you and your various books?
Well, there are two sides to T. Morris. There's the professional side, and that's the one that is currently making all the talks throughout New Zealand, both in Auckland and in Wellington. And you can find out more about the professional side of T. Morris at imaginethatstudios.com. You can also follow the professional side of T. Morris on Twitter at IT Studios. Then there's the snarky, goofy, off-the-wall side of T. Morris, and that's at tmorris.com, and that's TEEMORRIS.com, and on Twitter, that's T-Monster. And the nice thing about both places is there are links on both blogs for my books. So you can pretty much follow all the links to different articles that I've written, different books that I've written, and also available on both sites are links to my various podcasts. Some of the podcasts are getting ready to wrap up. I know that Kraken's Quest is getting ready to wrap up, and so is the Survival Guide to Writing Fantasy, which to your writers, you might enjoy some of the back episodes of that because that was the one that I wrote, that I did concerning marketing tips for writers.
Mm.
And those are the two best places to find me. And of course, if you want just the stories, just the fiction of T. Morris, you can check that out at patiobooks.com.
Fantastic. Well, thanks ever so much for your time, T. It's been great to talk to you.
My pleasure, Joanna. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You can get more information on writing, publishing options, sales, and promotion for your book at www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And you can also get your free How to Be an Author workbook at www.howtobeanauthor.com. See you next time!